Thanks for joining me at Stand to Reason. This is Jay Warner Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokel, who's away. I'm not even sure where. Is Greg on vacation right now? Is that where he is? I'm not sure if he's out. He might be on a speaking trip, I think he's on, because I think he's speaking in a couple days in Texas. In any case, I am glad to be with you and get a chance to talk about the stuff that matters most in life related to our Christian worldview. And by the way, I hardly ever will talk about this kind of stuff when I'm here hosting, but if you haven't checked out the Stand to Reason store, I want to suggest you do that. It is really simple. It's at store.str.org. And here's why I say that. First of all, you have an organization here, Stand to Reason, that has vetted some of the best materials for you. So if you're wondering, like, where should I start? What can I trust? Well, we've done that for you at Stand to Reason. It's a vetted store. So all those resources are there for you. Also, look, I mean, you know what? That Amazon's kind of taken over the world. And as an author, I know that too. But the reality of it is we don't always know that we can get the resources we want on that platform forever. We may, but I see more and more censorship even on issues that are the most important issues we can talk about related to our Christian worldview. Well, we're not going to have that problem at the STR store. And you get that betting takes place. And also you get to donate to something that helps to fund the most important kinds of ministries that we do in apologetics, which Stand to Reason is, I think, one of the oldest and one of the most secure. So if you want a place where you can actually spend your research money because you want to learn to be a better case maker, this is a great place to do it. Because number one, it's got vetted materials. Number two, you're donating at the same time. A small percentage of this will actually help sustain the organization itself. So I want to encourage you to go over to the store.str.org link and look at all the great resources that are being offered there. Okay, in this hour, before we go to calls, we've got a few who are stacked up here. And we'll talk about those in a minute. Also, our number, in case you want to join us, we've probably got room for maybe one more here at some point, and that is at 855-243-9975, or internationally at 562-424-8229. Okay, this hour, I want to talk about something that I really have talked about a couple times now publicly, because I'm still thinking about how best to communicate this and what my concerns are in this area. And part of it really kind of was born out of the whole Ravi Zacharias, and I thought Greg did a wonderful job on one of his monthly mails that comes to us, talking about how do we respond to the whole issue at RZIM. And without being, you know, jumping into that, it's just an example of some of the stuff we've seen in the last year in a number of places. We've seen kind of celebrity pastors, Christian singers who have either left the faith, been caught doing something they shouldn't be doing, either related to money or sex. We've seen Ravi, you know, so what's the one thing all three of these groups have in common? Have you seen this happen? You've seen, number one, celebrity pastors that have fallen. You've seen the deconstruction of leaders of the entire group. It seems like the blossoming Christian music industry of the early 2000s. That whole generation of Cutlass and Audio Adrenaline. When I was a youth pastor, these are the folks that would be at the Harvest Crusades. I would take my kids to these things. Skillet, you name them. All those big bands that were really good bands. I mean, I thought, well, this is like a renaissance in Christian rock right now that was really good. And there was a market for this. Oh my gosh, the sales of these bands was really decent, right? Well, would you be surprised to find that group of young men and women who became part of those rock bands, that many of them are no longer Christians or maybe never were Christians? And without really surprise, it doesn't surprise me, given what I know about what motivates us as humans. The one thing that all three of these groups have in common, the pastors who have fallen publicly, the Christian singers who have fallen publicly, even the apologists who fall publicly, the one thing they have in common, they were all celebrities. And I am concerned about the challenge that is posed to us as public Christians related to celebrity. And if you think, oh, well, that's only a narrow number of people. Well, really, we're in the social media world right now, where everyone who's got a phone can develop a social media platform. You don't have to be a famous pastor or a singer or a politician or a talk show host in order to host something on social. There are TikTok influencers. There are Instagram influencers whose only claim to celebrity is that they grew a large platform on. Anyone can do this now. Like the door to celebrity is now available to more people, given social media celebrity, than at any other time in history. So I think it's time for us to recognize the challenges that come along with celebrity. And I'll just throw it to you in a way that I think about it as a homicide detective. I've often said this, that the three things that lead to any misbehavior, including homicides, are financial greed, sexual lust, and the pursuit of power. If you read 1 John chapter 2, I think it starts in verse 18, you will see that he talks about these also, but they're worded slightly differently. But he's talking about sex, money, and power. Sex, money, and power. Those are the three things. The only three reasons why anyone commits a murder, there they are. Oh, there's a fourth category. No, there isn't. No, that category of power is a huge umbrella category that ropes in a lot of other misbehavior. And by the way, these three things are been given to us for good. There are good, holy, righteous ways to wield money, sex, and power. There are righteous ways to express ourselves in those three areas. And there are corrupted ways. And we as fallen humans have a tendency to corrupt what God has given us for good. And you see this all the time. And what I've learned, and by the way, that power section that I say is that big umbrella, it is. In murders, it's okay, well, why does somebody walk in and kill 50 people at a Walmart who look different than him? Because he thinks that his race is better. It's a power issue. It's an authority. Or it's just like, I'm better than you. Why does an addict steal from his family and without any sense of repentance? Because he thinks his high is more important than your property. It's about power. It turns out a lot of misbehavior is in that third category, the pursuit of power. When one gangster shoots another gangster because he was disrespected, what's that about? Authority, respect, power, it's in the third category. So, and if you say, well, how about people who are just vengeful? What are they vengeful about? It's one of those three things. How about people who are jealous? What are they jealous about? It's about one of those three things. Those three things are what drive all misbehavior, including the misbehavior of pastors and Christian singers and Christian apologists, because those are the same three motives that drive all human misbehavior. And if you wanted to guard yourself from that kind of misbehavior, well, it's really simple. You don't have to guard yourself from 1,000 things. Three things: sex, money, power. If you're pastoring, you got to guard yourself in those three areas. Now, here's what's interesting about it. What I've noticed is that when you start to explore any one of those three dimensions, you open the door to temptation in the other two. It's not like you say, well, look, my only issue is over here in this one area, so I'm good in those other two. Oh, really? Once you explore that, once you start pushing the envelope on that one area, the other two will come right along with it. You'll have increased chances of doing things over in those other two areas, and eventually you'll probably succumb to those. Now, why is that important in this discussion? Well, because it turns out that if all these things kind of are tethered and they rise together, let's put it this way. If I told you that I wanted to work for you and I've been a lifelong alcoholic, you might be hesitant to hire me. If I told you I've got a gambling problem, I'm an obsessive gambler, you might be. If I told you I had any other obsessive, but if I told you I was a workaholic, you would hire me because you'd say, wow, I take a workaholic. We have a tendency to promote that kind of a workaholic rather than an alcoholic. One we see as positive, right? They're overachievers. I want an overachiever in my firm. I'm happy to hire you. You'll stay extra 4 hours a night. Good for you. You're a workaholic? That's exactly what I'm looking for. We have a tendency to promote that and see that as a positive, even though it's every bit as destructive as any other obsessive behavior. But we see it as a positive because it does something that we want. Well, it turns out that the pursuit of celebrity is often the thing that we would champion, even though it opens the door to the other two things. So we, for example, after someone falls like a Robbie, we would say, well, why didn't his ministry have a better accounting of his financial resources to make sure he couldn't spend money in a certain way? Or we will say, why didn't his ministry send somebody with him to safeguard against his being alone with a woman and on a trip or whatever? We'll look at the sex and money side and say, well, we should be safeguarding them. We should be trying to tamp that down. We should be doing something to prevent any activity over there. But it's okay for him to grow a huge social media platform. And celebrity, we want to encourage. Why? Because more people will hear the gospel if he's more famous. It turns out we see, kind of like workaholism, this is the thing we actually don't feel bad about. We don't even see a need to put anyone alongside of you to control the level of celebrity you're attaining. But we do see a need to put someone alongside you to control the level of money or sex or opportunities for sex. Think about that for a second. The only problem with it, of course, is the more famous you become, you're able now to leverage that to get more money and get opportunities you wouldn't have if you were not a famous person. It turns out that fame opens the door often to the other two misbehaviors. So I think that for me, what it meant as I'm watching this, and I was shaken by what I saw last year with Robbie. And I thought, wow, what is that? So it comes down to this pursuit of power, because pursuit of celebrity is a subset in the pursuit of power. That's what it falls in that umbrella. And so, yeah, you're opening the door to all the other two, because if you're not a famous person who can then command ministry money and then has opportunities to go all over the world without accountability, this doesn't happen. It turns out that thing is what led to the other two. And so we have to help ourselves to see that, and I'm going to tell you, I write books. And a part of writing books is nobody writes a book they want no one to read. Nobody writes a YouTube video they want no one to watch. Nobody records a podcast like we're recording today or does a radio show they want no one to listen to. It turns out it's easy to write the book. It's hard to get someone to read it. It's easy to write, to make the video. It's hard to get someone to watch it. That's all down to marketing. How do we get the word out? And if you're somebody who's able to market and you become a celebrity, you've got a much better chance. And I see this all the time. Oh, I'm just building my social media platform so that I can have the opportunity to share Jesus with more people. At some point, is that going to flip? I often see it. It does flip. Oh, now I'm just preaching the gospel so I can build a larger social media platform. Which tail is wagging the dog? And that's really what we have to consider. And this is why I had to step back and say, okay, so look at my YouTube channel. And let me tell you what I saw. 1,000 videos on my YouTube channel with my face on them as a thumbnail. It's got to stop. So we are now going back and re-thumbnailing all the... I'm not going to be able to go back to 1,000 thumbnails. But going forward, there will not be a thumbnail. And my son also makes videos. And I called him. I said, hey, we're going to change this. We are interested in the content of what it is we are speaking about. And we want that to be famous. And we've taken this approach that, hey, the more famous we become, the more famous the... No. We have to go back to I write books and I want people to read them because I spent time researching them and I'm excited about what I've learned and I want to share what I've learned with you. You don't need to even know. I don't even care if you don't remember who wrote the dang thing. I don't care I read this book. I think it was called this. I don't even know who wrote it. That's great. That's fine with me. But we are now in an age where social media is all about how we look on Instagram. You're going to know what I look like, right? But don't we still do that? So we're just starting to go back and look at all those headers, all those places. We hope by the end of summer to have all of that replaced. And we're going to figure out and I've talked to people who have said, are you crazy? Advancing who you are advances your authority and that allows you to just preach the gospel. I don't care. We have to guard ourselves. Now look, I can say, hey, Christian culture, all my brothers and sisters, would you please back off on the idol worship of celebrity pastors and celebrity singers and celebrity apologists? I've got to convince millions of people to do with the right. Or I could just say, hey, the five or six of us who are in this position where we're talking about these issues, can we back off that? That's an easier sell, it seems to me. I think the responsibility for this is going to fall on me, not on the people who watch my stuff, not on the people who read my books. It falls on me to make sure that I protect myself in the area that most of us do not seek protection. We say, yeah, I can guard myself in terms of finances. I won't take any money for this. I can guard myself in terms of sex. I'll make sure I do all of this with my wife present. We do it as a couple. But then you grow this celebrity thing. And then eventually this does lead to the erosion and the temptation that comes with the other two. So I think that's the danger, is do we have a way of controlling our celebrity going forward? And are we willing to do that as a culture? And by the way, social media is not making us more social. It's just making us more tribal. And we have icons on each side of the tribe that we follow their lead. And we are happy to do that because it just has amplified the division. Everyone's a hammer looking for a nail. And so the reality of it is we have to do something. So part of this is probably going to be us minimizing or really being targeted about our use of social media. You know, I am somebody who really, if you're going to use social media, let's make sure you are in social relationships with the people who you are on that platform with. A lot of us have got thousands of people following us on social media, and I only know a handful of these people. And that's the kind of stuff that can lead to the kind of celebrity that very few of these Christian celebrities, would you agree, seem to have positive outcomes. It seems like when we read about Christian celebrity, it's a fall, and that fall has much more dramatic impact on the church at large if that person is of a higher celebrity. I actually think we should be praying for celebrities and praying that they aren't tempted by those things that typically tempt people once they become celebrities. All right, we're at a little bit earlier break than I was planning on being. We're a few minutes early, a couple minutes early, but we're going to take the break right now. When we come back, we'll start into our phone calls. I've got a couple of things I'll have to talk about. May not even get to those. We'll try to, but I hope that this has been helpful as you kind of rethink your view of Christian celebrity. We'll take a break right now, come back with more at Stand to Reason.
Friends, if you like this broadcast, I know you'll love hashtag STRAsk. It's our shorter 20-minute podcast where I am paired with the wonderful Amy Hall, and together we answer the questions you send us on Twitter. Hashtag STRAsk is released twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays, and it's only about 20 minutes long, so it's perfect to listen to on your morning jog or while driving around running errands or cleaning your garage or just plain loafing at home. Amy and I tackle your questions on theology and ethics and culture and lots more, offering our insight on the questions you're asking or the challenges you face. You can listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your own shows. Just remember, send us your questions on Twitter using the name of the podcast, hashtag STRAsk. That's hashtag STRAsk.
When you choose to support Stand to Reason with a monthly gift of $10 or more, you become a strategic partner in the work of equipping Christian ambassadors. Your monthly commitment makes you a part of a special group helping STR-trained Christians to confidently and graciously defend their convictions. Your monthly gift helps us plan and manage STR's resources and provides consistent support to aid our ongoing work. As our thanks for your partnership, we have created some benefits to express our gratitude, like a 10% discount in our online store, access to a private Facebook group, and more. To become a strategic partner, visit str.org/donate. Click How Often Will You Donate? And choose Monthly. For personal assistance, you can email Ocean Wilson at ocean@str.org.
The world says you can be a boy or a girl. You can be gay or straight. You can be cis or trans. There's no right or wrong way to define yourself. No one can tell you who you are. You decide who you want to be, and whatever that is, it can change whenever you want. That's because your identity is untethered to reality. It's chaos. But you don't have to listen to the world. You can listen to a different account of who you are, one told by your maker. And this one is anchored to reality and will bring you from chaos to clarity. Don't miss this year's Reality Conference. Go to realityapologetics.com to get dates and locations for the Student Apologetics event of the year.
All right, thanks for coming back with us here at Stand to Reason. Jim Wallace, J. Warner Wallace, sitting in for Greg Kokel. Most of you know that the reason why I call myself J. Warner Wallace is because of Greg, right? This is a guy who I was started my radio career basically, I think, with Greg. And he would ask me to come on and either be a guest or a host. And my name is Jim Wallace. And people would write in and say, you've had Jim, you're really open-minded, Greg, to have Jim Wallace, thinking I was Jim Wallace from Sojourners. And Greg eventually called me and said, hey, dude, you need to change your name. You're being confused for Jim Wallace from Sojourners. I was like, really? I got to change my name. Well, I was using J. Warner Wallace on all my search warrants because I love my grandfather's name is Warner, and I got that name from him, and I wanted to honor him on my search warrants. So I just thought, okay, I'll just use that as my pen name. And so when I wrote the first book, it came out as J. Warner Wallace. But actually, Greg is a person I still point to say, here's why I'm. And when I bring up Greg, let me just say something about what I love about Stand to Reason and about Greg. I don't know if you guys even know this, but Greg and I consider Greg one of my dearest friends. And we talk a lot. We text back and forth. And I will tell you that what I love about Greg is that he understands the idea of celebrity. That has never, in all the time I've known Greg, that has never been something he has chased. Never. He does the work. He lets God take care of the rest. He's the kind of person who doesn't try to game the system. He's not strategically trying to grow this or that. He just be faithful. Be faithful, and God takes what you do, and runs with it and blows it up into something beautiful. And that's what he's done with Stand to Reason. And that's what he does with Greg, which is why I love Greg. All the people we're talking about, you know, if you follow Greg Kokel at Stand to Reason, that's just not who he is. And that's to his benefit that he's not. That's not who he is. So that being said, I want to say one last thing before we take calls, and we'll take the first call, I think, from Deborah in Houston. But before I get to that, we talk about doing events, live events. And I don't know if you're opening up, your church is opening up again. It should be. I mean, most of these churches are starting to open up with the mask rules kind of changing. But I know that every state is a little bit different. Well, Stand to Reason, they've kind of mastered the technology that's important, that's needed to do live streams. So if you're not quite open yet and you're looking for a speaker, this is a great place to come. The speaker team here is fabulous, and they can do live streams, and they do it in a very good way, powerful way. The technology is getting better and better. But also now it's time to start to open up our doors, and if you want to have a speaker come out to your church, there's not going to be a better equipped speaker at just the right price that you can afford in your church, because they're doing it for the right reason here. So please call, email Darcy at booking@str.org. Darcy is at booking@str.org. All right. Looks like we're going to have Anonymous first. There's Anonymous call coming in. I'm being told by Amy on the text here that this is who's going to get the next call. So let's do that. Anonymous, how are you? Do you have a name I can use for you, or just going to, you can stay anonymous, of course.
You can call me Bill.
Okay, Bill.
So last week, the speaker was talking about, a non-biblical argument for premarital sex being wrong. Mm-hmm. I've grown up in the church, and I'm curious, I've never actually heard the biblical argument for premarital sex being wrong, and I've been seeing that happen a lot more in the church and what's going on with friends and in the church, and I was wondering if you could give me the biblical argument as to why premarital sex is wrong.
So my view of marriage comes from the teaching of Jesus of Nazareth. My Bible is, of course, just out of my reach, and I wanted to be able to, of course, pull up my Bible online, but as I've already described for you, I cannot get anything to work when I have used my camera, so I can't even pull up the verses I want to pull up. But a lot of it comes down to, like, what is the appropriate relationship between men and women? And Jesus talks about this in the context of marriage, that if you are not in the context of marriage, you are actually placing a woman in a position where she is in a form of adultery. And so the idea here from Jesus is that the only form of marriage is between a man and a woman. Okay, and so I take that, and this is what the covenant is in marriage. The covenant is not between you and a woman in a contract. If it was, well, then what do you need to be involved in a marriage ceremony at all? The covenant you're making is with God. As a couple, you're making that covenant with God. And so that's part of, for me, I'm looking at marriage as that, because I think I'll be honest with you, I was not a Christian in the first 18 years that I was with my wife. We were not Christians. And so my view back then was very, very different. You might be able to make a practical argument for whether or not sex outside of marriage is helpful, unhelpful, beneficial toward. But, you know, to be honest, all of the statistical, you probably heard that last week, all the statistical work that's been done on this shows that people who live together do not fare as well as people who are married. And if they live together and they eventually get married, they don't fare as well as people who wait until they are married before they engage in sexual activity. So, but for me, and I want to pull it up here, and I can't even pull up what I've written about this. It might be working. Okay, got it. I'm just trying to pull up my own website where I've got all the notes on this, and I can't even pull that up. So just so you know, I'm not talking like a crazy person. For me, when I use this camera, which we are live streaming through our Squadcast software, this camera is a USB camera. It plugs into my USB port. Unfortunately, so does my keyboard. And when I put in the camera, the keyboard says, well, you've chosen it over me. Let's see. Let me just see if I can find this on my... Okay. I think I can get it. Let's try it while it's still working. Okay. Okay, so this is from my own website on this question. Now, here's part of the problem. When I was a youth pastor, this used to always kind of like bug me that there was not a specific word in Scripture that describes any number of specific sexual behaviors when a question would arise. And a lot of times what you'll get is you'll get terminology that's in the original Greek or that's in Scripture that is much more general and talks about sexual immorality. And then the question becomes, well, then how do I determine, well, which behaviors fall in that category of sexual immorality? So, for example, 1 Corinthians 7, verse 2. But since there is so much immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. So Paul is basically saying here that marriage is kind of the remedy for sexual immorality. But the question then becomes, well, what is the, okay, so why is marriage, because again, he's saying that each man should have his own wife. So that's in the context of marriage in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 2. And that each woman should have her own husband. So the cure for sexual immorality is apparently a marital relationship between husbands and wives. So the best inference for this is that sex outside of that relationship between husbands and wives is in that definition of sexual immorality. Make sense? So 1 Corinthians 7, I think, is a good place to start, because it really argues that the best place for sexual behavior that God considers to be moral is in the context of husband and wife relationships. Basically, it's saying that you should not have sex outside of that marriage, that the best place, that the one way to have this that pleases God is with inside that marriage relationship. So if I had to go to one verse that just kind of describes it quickly, it would probably be 1 Corinthians 7, verse 2. And I was going to say it was verse 12, which I'm glad I was able to pull up the article to see which actual verse it is. So it's 1 Corinthians 7, verse 2 is, I think, a good place to go. Are there other places you can go? Yes. And you can make a cumulative case for this. I'll give you some of the verses. I'm not going to be able to go through all of them. I see my time limit here. Like Acts 15, verse 20. Read Jude 7. You can kind of get a sense of what behaviors God would see as immoral sexual behaviors. 1 Thessalonians 4, let's see, verses 3. Verse 3 is a good place to start there as well. Colossians 3, verse 5. So there are some places you can look in Scripture to make a cumulative case, but what I think is clearest is just this verse that I gave you in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 2. I hope that's at least a way to kind of start. But I will tell you, if you're looking for, you name whatever the sexual behavior that you're kind of wondering is, does God approve of that? They are going to fall under the general term of sexual immorality, or you'll see more general terms. And you're going to have to kind of discover, what does that mean? What does that term mean? By looking at other verses that use the term and then kind of give you the definition in a way that's not maybe as much as I loved it, for example, to say, well, we're sex before marriage. Can we just have the term sex before marriage in Scripture? Well, you're not going to find that. You're going to find that the term is going to be called sexual immorality. But when you look at what is defined as sexual immorality, you'll see that Paul, for here, for example, is talking about sex outside of marriage. So, hope that helps. That makes sense, Bill?
Yep.
Just a way to kind of at least start to kind of bite into the apple. So that's a big. I think, again, when you make cumulative case arguments from Scripture, it requires us to know enough about the verses to make a cumulative case. And I think that's really like can be kind of hard to do. So it's a challenge. But thanks for calling me, Bill. I appreciate you. Hope that helps a little bit.
Okay. Thank you.
No problem, Deborah. Let's go to Deborah in Houston next. Hi, Deborah. How you doing?
I'm fine, Jim. Thanks for taking my call.
I'm glad to do it.
Okay, so I started getting into apologetics recently because I have 5 grown children who are coming up with a lot of leftist ideas, and I'm here, whoa, where are they getting this from?
Right.
And I didn't, I'm secure in my own faith, but I couldn't really communicate it to them. So I came across Greg's tactic books on Amazon and read that, then digging into apologetics more, and just I'm talking to them instead of just shutting up. So one thing that's come up recently is was talking to my 19-year-old. She's the youngest. Mm-hmm. And she was talking about, Oh, she'd been talking with a friend, and she referred to this friend as they. I'm here, what? Mm-hmm. Weren't you just with one friend? She said, oh, this friend is non-binary. I said, oh, how can one person be they? That's a plural pronoun. I'm an English teacher. It's kind of a thing. But and she was, and then we were talking about, oh, well, sex and gender are different things. I said, what's your definition of gender? My definition of, you know, my definition of sex and gender are that they're the same thing. So she pulled up Stanford University. Would you accept their definition of gender? I said, Stanford? No. She was getting kind of flustered. So then she said, we need to talk to another sister about this. So got her on the phone. Turns out that she is wants to help people to transition from one gender to another. I didn't realize this. So she has obviously been thinking more about this than I have. But I want to at least keep the conversation going and keep it civil. So we were talking about, again, gender and sex. What's the difference? We got hung up on the gender identity thing, as well as intersex with this other daughter. So I'm here, well, I don't really know a lot about this, so let me learn something about it, and we'll come back to it another day. So,
first of all, that's really good approach, right? I mean, this is something we talk about here at Stand to Reason a lot. Is it okay to say, well, you know, I'm not quite sure how to respond to that. Let me do some research on it. I mean, I think we get a lot more respect from people when we do that, right? Than we just kind of jump off and maybe into an area that we're not even that comfortable with, or we haven't done any work in, and then we're like confused about the issues ourselves. And you see this all the time. And I also kind of worry as we get older that we get rooted in what we grew up with, and things are fluid, especially with this definition. Look, I have a birth certificate, and at the time I was born in 1961, these two terms were used interchangeably. Sex and gender were used interchangeably. As my birth certificate, when it's describing my sex, the box is labeled gender. This is my gender. Now, of course, the definition of gender has changed. And these are now, where they used to be interchangeable, they are no longer interchangeable. They really represent two different things. But on my birth certificate, they back in those days, they were interchangeable terms. But so I think knowing that those are no longer interchangeable terms at least will kind of help us begin the discussion. So I think you did the right thing. You used the tactical approach. You said, first of all, what do you mean by sex, or what do you mean by gender? Then that's good, because you need to get those definitions out. And so you can see this definition, really, sex right now, as we're using it. And by the way, I think this is going to change too. This may very well change in the next 10 years, where we're going to see and I think it's important to tell our kids that. Say, let's just remember that whatever the terms you're using today, they're going to be different than they were used in the past. Expressions change and terms change. Awful. Awful means bad right now, but it used to mean worthy of awe. It used to mean something good. The term has changed over time.
That's true.
So we have given different definitions to terms that we use. The term for, there's lots of terms like this that used to be good and now they are bad, or used to mean something bad and now they mean something good. So I think it's up to us to know what the definitions are and be able to point out the differences. Because there are differences between sex and gender, the way that we're using the words today, right? Sex is the thing that is biologically confirmable. When I get DNA at a crime scene, I can determine if my suspect is male or female in terms of their sex, simply from their DNA. That's not going to change. You can do all the sex change operations and all the everything you want to do to transition gender. You're not going to transition your DNA. Your DNA is still going to reveal your biological sex. It's driven by your DNA. It's driven by biology, not driven by your understanding or interpretation or desire from those things. It's driven by what is true biologically. And that's the way we use the word sex now. That used to be the way we would also use gender, but now gender really is about a kind of a social construct. Like, what is the role? What is the behavior? What is the expression or identity you have of girls, of boys, of men, of women? This is really more about the social construct that comes with this and not about the genetic link to biology. So these are two different things. And I actually think that as long as we understand that difference, we can move forward no problem. Because what we have is some confusion about whether or not my understanding of my social, what I accept as the social construct for my life, my gender, how I identify under gender, does this now open the door and allow me to do certain things that in the past were restricted not by gender roles, but by biology? So, for example, I might identify in gender as a, if I'm a 25-year-old MMA fighter, and there's been a few of these now, who is a male and wants to fight in the female division, should I be allowed to do it? Or is the, are sports one of those areas still where we don't think that gender restricts us? What restricts us is sex, biological sex, because with that biology come certain advantages that are attached not to your notion of your gender, but are attached to the truth of your biology. And where we have a problem, right, I think, going forward, we confuse those two things. We think, hey, you know, if I say I identify as a woman, it ought to qualify me then to do those things that have previously been limited based on biology, not based on gender identity, based on biology. And so I think what you're seeing is that's where that we're seeing conflict, right? That's why we're seeing that people are having this discussion. How can these two things, they see the absurdity in it. But I think, honestly, that as we kind of understand the definitions, we can kind of talk about these differences and we can avoid a lot of the misunderstandings, because it really is this thing you're about to propose, you ought to be have access to, is this the kind of thing that is restricted by a biological necessity, right? If it is, then you can say, you know, but you can't really do it. So, for example, very few people would put up with somebody identifying as, let's say, as a protected group. If I said, this is Asian Appreciation Month, okay? So I identify as an Asian. Do I get the honors that are bestowed upon people during Asian Appreciation Month? Well, if you said, well, no, you're not Asian. Well, yeah, but I identify as one. Very few people, it turns out that when you start to push it against other things that are genetically driven, that I can identify certain groups genetically because their biology makes this clear, right? The same kind of thing. Well, I can identify as somebody against my genetic makeup, but does that allow me then the privilege that you used to only, for example, affirmative action? If you said a minority groups get a certain access to things that they didn't have access to in the past, and we ought to make that wrong right through some affirmative action policy. Okay, fine. Can I come in now as the person who's had the benefit of not being part of that minority group and just say that I identify as that minority group and get the benefit of that affirmative action program? I think most people would say, no, you can't do that because you're not genetically a part of that minority group. Well, what's the difference? Again, if I can choose against my biological genetic makeup, whether that be my biological sex or my ethnicity or anything else that's determined by genes, why, again, some things we would say are really not about your gender identity. They're about physical necessities predicated by your biology. So I think we have to make sure that we understand those differences.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I think that's part of it. It's just us understanding that, yeah, there are two different terms now. And yes, they were at one time interchangeable. I don't know how old you are. I'm going to be 60 next month. So that, yeah, back in 1961, this was the terms were used interchangeably. But they aren't used that way anymore. And all we have to be is clear that some things, even though you may have a certain identity, you see it in a different way, some things are going to be limited by genetics. And you're not going to be able – I was reading an article – about 2 weeks ago, somebody who had gone through all of these surgeries and all this hormone treatment to change gender. I can't remember if it was somebody who changed, which direction they changed gender. But after doing like an Ancestry.com search just for their family members or whatever, they were discouraged to find that they had been labeled by Ancestry.com as either male or female based on their DNA. Like they thought that making the switch was somehow going to, but they're still going to be identified in terms of sex because we still use that term to define what it is you are, what your biology dictates, rather than what you, you know, you can determine sex at birth, but you might say now, we can't determine gender, though, until we have a discussion with the person to see what gender they've picked. So that's how they see the difference.
And
right?
then it can change gender too, right?
Well, sure.
That's
sure.
Like, I don't feel like being male today.
Right. But if we said, hey, we can determine your ethnicity or your race at birth, I mean, I think most of us would agree we could do that. But if we're going to have the same approach, couldn't I identify as a different race? You can't even identify my race then until I get to a certain age. But the reality of it is we do still hold on to some concepts that are driven by your genetics and instead of your choices. So anyway, I hope that this does it. At least it's a place to start. Go ahead.
Intersex. So she came up with, it seemed like a pretty high figure for intersex individuals. What do you do with those?
Okay, so you're talking about people who are born with both sexes. In other words, they have... Did you ask the question
that
we talk about? What's the first question you're going to ask in that conversation from a tactics perspective?
What do you mean by intersex?
Yes. What do you mean by that? And did you ask that question of her?
No, I didn't.
Because you want to ask that question first. Because I don't even know really what it is that she is defining as intersex, right? So it's usually used, and that's why I asked you. It's usually used with certain people who are born with certain variations, right, in their sexual characteristics, and usually this is driven by some form of genetics, so that you might have certain genitalia for both sexes, let's say. And we would have in the past seen that and said, well, there's something about that this is an abnormality, we would say in the past. Now, whether they're saying that anymore, that's another issue, right? But it's a very small group, number one. And why would we say that just because some people are born in that way, a very, very tiny fraction of people are born that way, that this has any bearing on someone's choice to be identified in under either gender? Why would we say, okay, the fact that there are people out there who are born with two sets of genitalia therefore means that you are justified or substantiated in holding a view that you hold related to gender? These seem to me to be two entirely different things. And I don't know how one relates to the other. So good question is that. Now listen, maybe I can be educated on this. I would simply ask, number one, what do you mean by that term? And two, why do you come to that conclusion that again, these are the two first tactical questions, right? What do you mean by that? And how'd you come to that conclusion? Or why do you think that's true? So those are the first two questions I would ask, and we'll see how far that goes. I think those two questions, though, will illustrate the point that the fact that somebody says, you know, that they are born with a certain physical characteristic, a very small percentage, which has always been seen as a deformity or an abnormality, right? This is something that, how does this affect somebody else who's not one of these people who have an intersex biology, who claim to be one gender or another? These are two separate issues. And what you do to remedy somebody who's born in an intersex situation and what you do to remedy somebody who is not are two different approaches altogether. So I don't even know how these two things cross over. So I want to know too, well, how is it then that the existence of this group somehow validates anything we think on either side as a conservative Christian or as otherwise? How does it have any impact at all on what position I hold over here? Does that make sense?
Okay. Yes, it makes sense.
But again, you won't even have to go that far because you're going to ask those two questions first. What do you mean by intersex? Two, why do you think that has any impact at all on how we view this other issue? And once you ask that, let them empty that out. And at the end of that, you're like still thinking, I'm not sure how to respond to that. You know what to say. You're going to say, well, okay, that's good. Now at least I know where you're coming from. Give me some time to think about that and we'll talk about it again.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate it, Deborah. Okay, so now we have a few extra minutes here. Let's go to David in Ohio. Hey, David, how are you?
Good. How are you, Jay?
I'm doing good. Thanks for being so patient. I appreciate you.
That's fine. Yeah, my question was just about if you had any perspective on the psychedelic DMT. It's being promoted, I guess, off and on by Joe Rogan.
Yeah. So are you... Tell me what your position is on the use of any kind of prescription drug as a Christian? I mean, is this a question just about that specific drug, or is it a question more about the use, our Christian response to using any kind of drug?
This is more of a question of mm-hmm. this particular drug. It's very compelling for people who are very motivated by experiential, because it does cause hallucinations. Many of these hallucinations seem to have similarities, which gives more credence to the drug as well. My view on most drugs is only if it's absolutely needed, such as clinical depression with antidepressants.
Yeah, no, okay, so my view, okay, now at least we're clear on what it is you're asking. Okay, very good. Yeah, I feel the same way. Forget about DMT for a second, which is, you know, this substance that you're right, is it basically occurs in some plants, it occurs in some animals, it can be amplified in some ways, but in the end, how is it being used and what is it being used for? So I always think that the best use of drugs is when we have something that, because of the fall, as Christians, we're in a fallen world, it's not the world that God created. Cancer is not something that God wants in the world. It's something that is in the world because of the fall. We are in a corrupted environment. The new heaven, the new earth will be cancer free. We are in the world that has occurred as a result of the fall. So what we do is we try to use those either approaches, medical approaches, treatments, drugs, holistically or otherwise, that treat the symptoms of the fall. So you're right. You might say, well, look, you know, can I justify using the technology and the plant-based drugs or even the drugs that God, that men create and men and women create? Can I use those things to solve illnesses? I'm in favor of doing that, because the illnesses is part of the fall. And what we're trying to do is to solve whatever is part of the fall. But we have an entire category of drugs that are purely recreational. Let's be honest. They are recreational. You might say, well, look, I'm going to use morphine. If I'm at a hospice and I've got somebody who's dying of cancer in a hospice situation, we do use morphine in those situations, right? We use them not to create hallucinations, but to kill pain so that they can pass without the anxiety that is created from pain. So we do all that at the end of life. But again, what we're trying to do is a very specific purpose to address a symptom of the fall. And so I'm in favor of using drugs in that way. If there's a treatment for cancer, I'd be in favor of doing it. But a lot of these are really just recreational. Like, I have this experience. I'm after an experience. Either you could argue, well, it's not a recreational experience, Jim. I'm after this psychedelic kind of spiritual experience. Again, like you said, is it necessary? Am I treating something that is the result of the fall, using the brain and the resources that God has given me to develop techniques and approaches and drugs that can treat the features of the fall, then I'm in favor of doing that. Again, it's necessary, right? Because we're trying to, and we see people are cured of cancer based on medical technology, based on drugs that are being used today. I'm all for that. But what we're talking about, and I'm pretty libertarian about the use of even recreational drugs, because I kind of feel like until you have a change of heart, I don't know that the war on drugs has been, and I'm a cop, and I don't know that the war on drugs has been all that effective. I mean, at the same time, I will tell you that there are secondary and tertiary effects of narcotic use. I worked undercover for a number of years. In all those years I worked undercover, I was working mostly robbers, active robbers who were doing robberies, armed robberies. And we would be, we'd get a line on somebody, would say, hey, I think this guy's doing a robbery. We would go sit up on this guy. And we would watch him for a week and see if he was doing robberies. And we'd take him to jail as soon as we found out he was. But for the first part of that week, he's not doing robberies. He's getting high. And then when he ran out of money and ran out of dope, he went out and did a robbery so he can get high again. So I know that there are secondary and tertiary. So I'm kind of libertarian about in my kind of view of this. But at the same time, I know that practically speaking, we have to take people to jail for these things, because they are not victimless. They typically will usually fund their drug use by some form of theft. So, I mean, this is what we see over and over and over again. So I'm more inclined then to see this as something we have to address from a criminal perspective. But what I see, though, is these are not people who are stealing medication to cure themselves of cancer. These are people who, for the most part, are using narcotics to get a high that they can't get, to have an experience which is not a result of the fall. They're not trying to eliminate pain so much as they are just trying to get high. And they enjoyed that process. They want to do it again. You'll see people who will stumble into heroin use because a buddy's using heroin, and before long they're hooked. They love it, And then they were hooked into heroin. It wasn't because they were ever addressing an aspect of the fall. They simply wanted the high. So that being said, I'm kind of like you in that sense, that DMT or anything else that really is designed primarily to give you a psychedelic experience, I think is outside of the proper use of this kind of medication. Because again, yeah, what we're doing with medication is treating a symptom of the fall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What would you say to somebody? Yeah. What would you say to somebody who is considering taking it or has already taken it and has had this experience that they consider good?
Right. Well, this is why it's recreational, right? They've had an experience now that the high was powerful enough that they want to experience that again. Mm-hmm. This is true of alcohol use too. I mean, you can be somebody who overdrinks because you just don't want to be in a state of sobriety, because sobriety is not nearly as palatable as being high all the time. And I get that. And this is why at some point, but again, are we doing this because we're treating a condition? Are we doing it because we're treating an illness? And that's the question I would have. I say, you know, I'm in favor of all kinds of drug use as long as it is treating an illness, treating something that is a result of the fall. Where I draw the line is where I'm just making an idol of an experience, and I simply want to have these good experiences. You would say, look, if all you ever do is you want to be on vacation all the time, you would say that's probably not a productive life. It's probably not a fruitful life. You're just chasing experiences, one experience after the other. Well, it turns out that people who use drugs that they have to buy illegally not only are chasing experiences, but they often end up victimizing people who aren't, because they want the money they need to chase the experience. So at some point, we would say, okay, that's where you draw the line, right? So I think, again, that what you said was just the absolute – the question is it necessary, right? Or is it just something that – you know, it's about want and need. And what a lot of times when drug use is simply can be divided that way. Is this a need or a want? If it's a want, you're probably pretty well advised just to avoid it, because when we get into wants, we get into all kinds of crazy stuff. If it's a need, well, then we can discuss what the need is. And then you've got several options to be able to treat the need. Mm-hmm. So I hope that's at least a little bit helpful for you.
Yeah. I'm kind of wanting a little more specifics on the actual drug itself, though.
Yeah, you know, I've only heard about, like you're saying, Joe Rogan. There's a few others who have talked about this, and I have not spent any time or never met anybody who's experienced a high under this. And, you know, my son is working in a position, like I worked in the back room of our agency for a number of years, and we had a narcotics team we were working with, and the number of things we would work was much more narrow in its range than the kinds of things we're seeing today. So I have not personally had any experience with DMT. I just know what I've read about it. I just know what tangentially what people have said about it. But again, when you meet someone who's a heroin addict, and I've interviewed like hundreds of heroin addicts, then you get a sense of what they're experiencing, because they're telling you about what the experience is like. And I always ask questions. Back when LSD was really big, when I first started my career, I would want to know, like, what is the attraction to this, right? So, I mean, I really wanted to know. So I would just, when I was doing interviews and these guys would take to jail, I would ask the question, because they're still high while they're in my custody for the first couple of hours, and they can still talk to me, but they're going to come off this, and then they're going to be impossible to talk to, because they're going to be in, you know, they're going to be detoxing. So I wanted to know while they were still high, tell me what you're experiencing that is so attractive that you'd be willing to do this crazy thing that's going to cost you this much time in jail. What is so attractive about this? And you know, when you talk to people who have had those experiences, they you can see, oh, I can kind of see why you might have been tempted in that area. So again, that's because I've never talked to anybody who's ever used it. I just don't know enough about it to be able to give you an educated guess.
I have talked to somebody who has used it.
Okay.
And they kind of describe this kind of loss of ego and kind of curbing of anger and negative emotions.
Well, you know, there's a lot of other ways to get that from a chemical perspective. Right. I mean, illegal ways. I mean, even other illicit illegal drugs that I've heard the similar stories to about this, right? But almost everyone I've ever talked to, David, when they are involved in bad behavior, they will find some way to justify it for you. At least to help you understand, like, why do I do this? I'm not a bad person. I don't do this because I'm a bad person. I do this because I have this need number X, you know, whatever it is. So I'm not surprised that whoever you're talking to would, number one, pitch it as not violent, right? Like all these good things he's telling you. It makes me a better person, basically, he's saying. Of course, the real question is that true? But anyway, that's not unusual to hear people justify their behavior that way. Hope that helps you, David, as we are kind of wrapping up this hour. I'm not sure I still have you on the line with me right now anyway, but if I do, thanks so much for calling in with that question. I wish I knew more about DMT that I could tell you more just from the people I've talked to, but I unfortunately have not talked to a lot of people who have used it. All right, that's we're getting close to the end now here, so we are a few minutes before the ending, and I don't see anybody else in our queue. So before I kind of shut this down for this week, and we've got a couple of minutes here, let me just kind of do a shameless pitch. If you're somebody who's wondering how it is that we got to a place in culture where we want to defund the police, where we want to even talk about that, and look, and I get it. There's lots of stuff that I'm seeing as well as a police officer that no one's more angry about misbehavior from police officers than people who aren't misbehaving as police officers. No one hates a dirty cop more than a cop who's not dirty. And there's a sense of frustration I feel about it too. And so the question becomes, well, what do we do to change it? What do we do? How do we encourage people to stay in the profession when so many are leaving in large numbers, either through retirement or through choices for other professions? Well, we're trying to address that at thinbluelife.com. I would invite you to join us over there if it is helpful. Also, remember that when we do the reality conferences, they're coming up. Please join us at Reality this year, from chaos to clarity. I'm going to tell you that some of the questions that came in today are absolutely, like gender issues, are absolutely going to be addressed in a robust way at our conferences. And so a lot of the hot topic issues that are in culture right now will be addressed as we try to sort out the chaos that the culture is presenting to us and talk about it from the perspective of biblical clarity. So I hope that you will join us at those five locations here in Southern California: Seattle, Minneapolis, Atlanta, and Dallas. Don't miss those conferences. Okay, that's it for us this week at Stand to Reason. Thanks so much for joining us, and I look forward to being with you again. And I think later this month I'm coming back and we'll do it one more time. So until then, join us again here at Stand to Reason.